Because it's a great time to be a seller. And you said it's better to build than to buy these things because everybody wants them. So who are these people that why does everybody want storage and why are they willing to pay such an exorbitant price for them right now?
Self-storage has been the best performing major asset class out of all other major asset class types. It's performed the best during recessions, the best during peaks. It's just a very stable, consistently performing asset class.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea, here with my amazing co-host, Ryan Gibson. What's going on?
All right, Tate. I think you're recording this one from a U-Haul truck. And I get the pleasure of reporting live from South Beach, where I've actually never been to South Beach. It's kind of nice.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm in a U-Haul truck. That's why my background is blurred. Otherwise, it would look like I'm in a cop car. And I'm recording here because we're setting up an Airbnb here in Nevada. And it's an empty house. And so it was too echoey in there. So I'm sitting here in the garage in the U-Haul van. That was the least echoey place I could find. And here we are. So if you've listened to any of the previous episodes about the cost segregation studies and using bonus depreciation to write off some active income, you could probably guess what I'm doing up here. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to our last episode with Billy Withers. We talk about it there. We also talk about it with Toby Mathis in episodes 10, 14, and also with Yona Weiss. Get schooled up on cost segregation studies because they are amazing. Ryan, what are you doing down in Miami?
Well, I was going to say, despite what you're doing or what we're doing, the show must go on. We're here for our listeners. And I'm down here actually speaking at a real estate conference, a little meetup down here with some investors that are looking to grow their businesses, but also real estate investors as well. So just kind of talking to the group. We had a nice dinner tonight and then we're doing some educational stuff. So really excited about that. And then headed back to Seattle.
Amazing. Well, it's just the two of us with you today. We wanted to take some time to talk about cap rates, forced depreciation, how to create value in real estate, or more specifically, how commercial real estate is an amazing avenue for forcing value creation, and how some of the data that you see floating around out there about real estate versus equities is maybe misleading because it doesn't take into account the fact that you can actually create value. You don't have to wait around for it. And then we're going to transition into storage. It's an asset class that I've always loved. Turbine Capital it's been a staple, a long time staple of the investment offerings that we bring to investors. And just today, we launched to our investor group the self-storage growth fund that Ryan, your company, Spartan Investment Group, is operating. So love to dive into that. So without further ado, Ryan, would you like to kick us off on value creation in real estate and sort of a brief overview of cap rates?
Yeah. So I always like to just simplify it as much as possible. And, you know, a cap rate is effectively the interest that you would earn if you bought a property all cash, or the rate of return that you'd get if you bought a property all cash. And it's the easiest way to do it. But really, you know, I like to think of it as a company that buys real estate and improves it, that for every dollar that you save or earn, in addition to what you're currently saving or earning, you're adding $16 approximately of value to the property. So let's just say an operator finds a way to charge a premium on a tenant, and it's $1 for that unit, right? That unit goes up $1 in rent. You can increase the value by $16, which is basically dividing by 0.06. And so cap rates are something that we use to value property in real estate. And so when you think about how much income does the property produce, that is what your cap rate is. So if you have a property you buy for $1 million and it produces $60,000 of income after expenses, not including debt, that has nothing to do with cap rates, that's a 6% cap rate. So it's really the value on that. And people will value certain assets at cap rates. So you have the, you know, you have the cap rate based on a property and its income potential, but then you also have people that pay like a market rate for a property. So in self-storage right now, new construction, investors are paying somewhere between a 5.5% and a 6% cap rate for new construction. So if you build a facility, regardless of how much it costs you, you're going to look at the income potential of that property. And that's what somebody might be willing to pay based on a 5.5% or 6% cap rate. So you can take all the income it produces, divide it by that cap rate, and that's your valuation. So that's what we do in the growth fund. We essentially build properties at a much lower cost than what the properties are worth when we sell them. And so that's kind of a long explanation to a simple answer, but that kind of gives you some perspective on cap rates.
Yeah. So, and why are we sitting here talking about cap rates? If your head is spinning right now and you're going, why does this matter? Well, it matters because residential properties, as many people have picked up on now, are valued based on comp or comparative analysis. So if your neighbor's house sells for a bunch more, it means your neighborhood's going up in value and your house will then appraise for more money. That is not how commercial real estate works. Commercial real estate trades on a multiple. Cap rate is just, like Ryan said, if you bought it all cash, it's the interest that you would earn, the cash flow that would sort of mirror an interest rate. Said another way, you know, for anybody familiar with businesses trade on multiples, right? If I'm going to pay 10 times earning for your business, or 20 times, or 100 times, or maybe a very small multiple. Stocks trade on the same thing. It's the PE ratio or price to earnings ratio. You know, a typical average stock market PE ratio would be about 16. If it's less than that, it's cheap. And if it's more than that, you could say that it's, you know, quote unquote expensive, right? So the multiple is the cap rate. And that's just one data point. The other data point is how much money the property makes. So the more money that the property brings in, income minus expenses equals net operating income. So the higher the NOI multiplied through the cap rate equals the higher valuation. So this is one of the things that I think gets missed when I was doing a bunch of research the other day on real estate versus stocks over 145 years, the last 145 years, and they're neck and neck. It's like 8.5%, 9%. And a lot of data shows that equities, stocks, have outperformed real estate. But that doesn't take into account the ability to force appreciation, to create that value, to increase net operating income, which is what we do in syndication deals, most syndication deals. So, you know, if you buy a property and you just sit on it and you just let it appreciate, sure, you know, I think they're probably neck and neck with the S&P. But when you go into these opportunistic opportunities, opportunistic projects where there's meat on the bone to improve operations financially, improve the physical asset, and at the end of the day, the most important thing is to increase that dollar value, that net operating income, that annual bottom line, that is what drives tangible, real, appraisable value in the asset. So Ryan, do you want to take a swing at that?
Yeah. Yeah. So like when you build a new property too, like there is no cap rate, right? When you buy raw land, you know, what we're doing in the growth fund, we're buying raw land and we're improving the property, building a self-storage property, and then we're proposing to sell it. And that's what generates a return. So somebody might be thinking, okay, so where is the margin? How do I make money here? Well, what we do whenever we look at a ground up development project, we look at all the costs that go into a building. So we look at the land, construction costs, financing costs, lease up losses, everything that would go into building and operating that business. And then we say, okay, that property might be a $10 million total project cost. That's what we refer to it as. But when it's stabilized, that property is going to produce how much income, right? So if the property is going to produce so much NOI or net operating income, that's where we can calculate what the cap rate based on our original cost was. And that's what I call cap on cost. And so we're building these, just to save you the math, we're building these properties for 10 to 11% cap on cost or yield on cost. And so if someone's willing to pay 5% cap rate valuation when that property sells, we're getting a really big spread in the middle of, you know, 5 to 6%. That means millions of dollars of profit that is there at the end. So, you know, when you're wondering how why a ground up development project would be good right now, it's because you can build it for a lot less than what they're selling for. Even in a market that might be headed, you know, lower to lower valuations, we're really hedging in a tremendous amount of equity in the front. So,
right. And to bounce back to what I was talking about in terms of squeezing additional NOI or net operating income out of a property, that's more of a value add play. So you buy an existing facility, you improve it. But why do you think right now, because I completely agree with you, but why do you think right now it's better to build than to buy?
Nobody can get loans right now. Banks are failing all over the place. Construction is expensive to most people, are unattainable. Land values are up, and it's hard to find and put together the capital to build a project. So a lot of projects just aren't getting built. And that means that there is a tremendous amount of opportunity to build today and have a great valuation later because of the lack of inventory that was being put on the market. There's some really great markets we're finding. So where the rents are super high, properties in a very desirable area, and we've had to take it through its paces, rezone it, permit it, whatever. Now it's all approved and under construction. So I think now's a good time, because if you go to just buy a property that already exists, good luck. You know, you're going to buy that thing at a really low 5% cap rate, and you're going to have to go find you're going to get 8 or 9% debt. And you're going to have this negative leverage situation where it's really hard to squeeze value out of that property. Let's face it, you're buying it kind of at peak pricing. Where if you build from the ground up right now, or buy something with the most value at upside potential, you have a lot of wiggle room in this market and a lot of opportunity to come out the other side where there hadn't been a lot of properties built and there's tremendous upside. So I think it's the thing to do, which is why it's been the most popular investment we've had this year, because, you know, it's you can build cheaper than you can buy. And it just makes a great opportunity. You just have to be partnered with an operator that can get the cash and has the resources to actually build in this market, where a lot of, I get requests all the time from other self-storage operators. Hey, do you guys do funding? Hey, can I get a loan from you guys? Because they can't get financing. And that means their projects are being put on hold. It's a great time to get into the space.
In terms of renters and buyers of the facility itself, where's that demand coming from? So let's first talk about the renters. Let's talk about self-storage demand, because a lot of people think, where are all these customers coming from? It's just people that have too much stuff. We've talked about this many times over the last 5 years on webinars and all sorts of things, but let's reiterate.
Whenever I speak in front of a group, I always ask, hey, who here has used self-storage or knows somebody who's used self-storage? Every hand in the room goes up.
Yeah.
Right. And I say, why did you use self-storage? And people say, downsizing, relocation, I changed my job, death in the family, got married, got divorced, jumped in an RV, traveled the country. I had to free up my house because I was working from home, or I had a gym, or it was COVID, or whatever. But all of these things are life events. Or the person says 30% of our customers are business users. And so then I always say, okay, keep your hand in the air if you used your self-storage facility because you have too much stuff. And all the hands go down. And I know as Americans, we have way too much stuff, and storage is popular in America, but most people are using self-storage because life happens. I don't like to call it a recession-resistant asset class. I like to call it a benefactor of disruption. You know, if you're moving, you're downsizing, you're doing a renovation, if you're doing something in your house or in your life that requires you to move or to be on the move or to free up space, people are going to use storage. And guess what? Doesn't matter what's going on in the economy, that's always going to happen. So we look for markets where there hasn't been enough self-storage built and where there's an excess amount of demand.
Excellent. Yep. I couldn't agree more. I think people are surprised by the business use case. You know, people don't really realize that you said 30% of your customer base is businesses.
Yeah. So like one of the properties we built just outside Seattle, the first like 7 units leased up instantly. and it was all a furniture staging company. And so they wanted all the exterior units that faced the main drive aisle so they could pull their trucks up, swap out furniture. They wanted multiple units side by side so they could have different things, you know, to use. And they were dying for a storage space because there's 10,000 houses being built in that market. So they're constantly restaging, moving the equipment to a different unit. So that's a great example. Sheet metal contractors, Little League baseball teams, food distributors, newspaper distributors, Amazon, Etsy businesses. Heck, we've had the Chamber of Commerce rent a lot of our units, judges, you know, Little League baseball teams. You know, everybody is really, anybody who's going to have a business operation that's going to require some kind of storage component to it, it uses self-storage. So it's got a really big use just outside of just the personal. A lot of landscaping companies as well, car, vehicle storage, you know, pretty much any type of business is going to transact and use the space.
So good. Yeah, I think that's such a missing component of a lot of people's analysis of it. So thanks for clarifying that.
And how do we add value, right? So like, so people say, well, you know, Ryan, I'm an investor in multifamily and the operator buys like 300 units and they rehab 100 of them. And then they put in washer and dryers and countertops and cabinets. And then they bump the rents $200 a month or whatever. And they put it back online. I think what's really cool about storage is people, we have what's called ECRIs, existing customer rent increases. So when we look at, you know, buying a property, we're looking at what the market's doing as a way to back into what we can get in rent. And we will find a mom and pop facility that there's been no existing customer rent increases or ECRIs in many, many years. And we can bring that rent up to market. And just by doing that, we add those dollars per month and NOI, which just shoots the value of the property up tremendously.
You can do that in multifamily as well. And a lot of times if you buy, you know, something where the rents are $800 and the market is 1,000 and you bump them to 1,000, well, somebody might be, I've lived here for a couple of years, I'm ready for a change. Nobody wants to go rent a storage truck and move all their stuff.
Yeah. It's a subscription-based business at the end of the day. And that's what's really cool too, is it's a 30-day lease. So we can adjust the rents every 30 days. But so you're probably thinking, oh, well, your customers probably turn over all the time. But our average day is about 38 to 40 months, typically, depending on the time of the year.
And, way longer than multifamily.
Yeah, it's a very sticky business. It's kind of like getting a gym membership and then, you know, canceling, you know how hard that is. But in this instance, you got to get a truck and a van and move out there. And usually by the time you get to the storage unit and roll the door open, it's just a pile of stuff. And you're like, man, this is the last thing I want to do, is like figure out how to get rid of all this stuff. So, you know, it's just it's a really sticky business at the end of the day. And, you know, when we build new ones, we look in markets where the rents are $160 for a 10 by 10. So we look in markets where the rents are super high, so we can justify building a really nice brand new facility. And I think that's what's so great about the growth fund is, you know, we're in markets where the rents are between $20 and $25 a square foot, which is essentially that 160 plus dollar amount. So, you know, even if rents go down or there's another facility built in the market, we still have the rent power of that market to sustain, you know, other competition coming in, which is can be a challenge. The other thing that we like to do is we like to find the land first. So like, hey, we'd really want to build a property here. And then we work into, okay, what land's available or what land can we acquire? And it might not be zoned right. It might not be zoned for self-storage. It might be restricting people from building self-storage in that market. So we love those types of markets where we basically have a moat around our competition where no one can come in, or it's very difficult to rezone or retitle a project. And we actually have a team at Spartan that's dedicated to rezoning and permitting and doing these things so that we have the capacity to continue to buy and build in those types of markets.
Yep. Excellent. So let's switch gears to the buyers on the exit. So when you're, you know, because it's a great time to be a seller, and you said it's better to build than to buy these things because everybody wants them. So who are these people that why does everybody want storage and why are they willing to pay such an exorbitant price for them right now? You know, I'm partners with you on a deal where we just sold a pretty crappy facility for a 3.2 cap rate and someone bought it. So who are these people? Why is there so much money pouring into it? What are you seeing?
Yeah. So, I mean, we see institutional groups, the publicly traded REITs aren't buying much right now, just in general, just they're kind of pencils down. But large private institutional shops that have big check writers behind them are going to buy this stuff. That's kind of at the top of the food chain. But the one that we were just talking about, Tate, that we just sold in Georgia, that property actually was sold to a mom and pop operator who is just operating properties in the area, and he just wanted another one in his backyard. And so, you know, he came in and built, you know, bid a higher rate than, you know, a lot of the more regional and national operators that were bidding against them, because he really wanted to win that deal. He really wanted a deal in the backyard. So I would say we're selling to everybody from mom and pop operators in a local market to some of the top institutional buyers that are private in our space, and everybody in between. You know, we've sold 7 properties as of late, and it's ranged the gamut from mom and pop all the way to, you know, one of the top 10 operators in the country. So it's all over the place. And I think that's what makes it so attractive, is there's always a buyer for the property, because in general, it's pretty easy to operate and easy to own a property like that. So,
well, that's my next question, or the next sort of phase of the conversation I want to get into is, you know, you and Scott started Spartan how long ago?
9 years ago.
There we go. So why storage? And I know this story, but the listeners don't. So why was it that, you know, out of multifamily, mobile home parks, senior living, storage, industrial, I mean, the landscape is vast. So how'd you land in on self-storage and decide that was what you were going to go after?
I actually think it was 4 things, really. I mean, the decision-making criteria that we set out was we wanted something that was easy to own, easy to evict, and easy to maintain. And so self-storage, you know, the most powerful thing in a self-storage lease is right in the second paragraph. It says the owner has the right to lien the occupant's belongings in the event of non-payment, you know, something to that effect. And basically, if you don't pay after 30 days, we can put a lien against your belongings. Now, every state's a little different or whatever, but you can then go through the lien process and actually get your unit back and charge your customer, you know, auction off their belongings and use a portion of the proceeds to pay back the losses that you've had while you went through that process. Now, of course, if there's a Ferrari in there and somebody pays $100,000 for it and the customer only owes $50,000, like you'll get your, what you've lost in rent and legal fees, but the customer gets the rest. So auctions aren't like this thing that makes us a ton of money, but it's a great way to evict. You know, there is no really evictions, and that's statewide. So we love the fact that, you know, blue states, red states, doesn't really matter. I mean, some states are getting a little weird about storage rents and stuff like that, like New York and California. We stay out of those states, but, you know, we can be in Washington and Oregon. We can be in Texas and Florida. It doesn't really matter. Right. And then the maintenance, you know, we don't have huge, you don't have water heaters in every unit and countertops in every unit and paint every time a tenant moves out. We have 4 corrugated steel walls, metal walls in a concrete slab, right? And so that's really cool. And then, you know, what we love is the operations. You know, we can have a 700 unit facility and 1.5 employees that manage it, you know, a full-time employee and a half-timer to back that person up a little bit. So just the overhead and the scale is tremendous. But the last thing I think is the most appealing, which is if you look back over the last 40 years, self-storage has been the best performing major asset class out of all other major asset class types. It's performed the best during recessions, the best during peaks. It's just a very stable, consistently performing asset class.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I love multifamily. We own a lot of it, and I'm a big proponent of
Same.
It. Yeah. But storage is very attractive for all those reasons.
Yeah, and the returns to multifamily are very similar. You know, you're just, you're getting an asset diversification strategy in your portfolio. I mean,
exactly.
And that's the thing that people, I think, like to compare asset classes and really get deeply involved. But there's so much more than that. So, you know, it's like, what kind of risk are you taking on within that asset class? You know, who's the operator? Who's your sponsor? How have they been, you know, how have they weathered storms? You know, what have they been through? So, you know, I think it's much more deeper than that. But, you know, fundamentally, the self-storage asset class has been very strong, and it's been a very good industry. And it's set up for success in the way that you can evict, the way that you have 30-day leases, et cetera. You know, you're positioned really well structurally for success, which I think is what's really attracted us to the space.
Well, speaking of weathering some storms, let's talk about some challenges that you've had, because I know, you know, I've watched your team grow tremendously over the last 4 or 5 years. Your experience level grow over the last 4 or 5 years. So you want to share on the podcast here a couple of real challenging situations that you guys have been able to navigate?
You know, miles makes champions, you know, as they say. You know, when I was a rower, that was one thing that, you know, our coach would tell us, you know, miles makes champions. You know, the more mileage you put on, the better trained you are, the better fit you are to, you know, to challenge and weather a storm. And, you know, I think when operators first get started, they don't have a lot of miles under their belt. They haven't experienced a lot of bumps and bruises. And I'll say that our team has been through, you know, quite a bit of challenges. You know, maybe not as much as somebody who's been in the business for 50 years, but certainly we had our challenges of peak pricing in 2021 and buying at a time where, you know, cap rates were compressing, interest rates were zero, and, you know, this product was flying off the market, and getting stuck in times where we were going for financing in properties where the interest rates were going up, you know, 75 basis points every other week. And we got stuck with loans that were higher interest. So that's been a challenge. The other challenging thing we've had is, you know, we would never really underwrite rent growth in a pro forma. You know, back in 2018, 2019, 2020, you know, we'd underwrite a modest, you know, 6 to 7% rent growth over like a 5-year hold. And then
hang on. For listeners that are starting to get lost in underwriting and rent growth and all that stuff, let's break those things down real quick and then we'll continue. So
underwriting is just a projection. When you underwrite something, you just say, hey, I think that the rents are going to go up this much, or I think that, you know, we're going to achieve what the facility down the street's going to get in rents. And here's all the inputs to it. You know, how many units do you have? What sizes are those units? What are you going to charge by the unit? What kind of debt do you have? You know, what interest rate, what amortization? That's kind of all, everything that goes into your underwriting.
Yeah. If you've ever heard, you know, someone say, you know, analyzing properties, right? If you're looking for rental properties and you're going to analyze them. And so you look at how much your mortgage is going to be and how much you can charge in rent and your utilities. And so you figure out your income and expenses, and then what are you left over with? But underwriting is a much more sophisticated version of that, which is an extremely complicated spreadsheet. And there's nuances to it that, you know, you have to have a keen eye to pick out. You know, if you want to see a 25% return on your projections for your investment, no problem. Sponsor can snap their fingers, tweak a couple little numbers in the underwriting spreadsheet, and it spits out a 25% projected return. So it's very, very nuanced and very important that a sponsor is using conservative assumptions that are going to drive. I always say the underwriting is like the engine and the transmission. And the exterior of the car is the projections. That's the big shiny, but you know, you got to pop the hood and see what's actually powering it, right? What's actually, you know, what's the gearing of the transmission? So when Ryan is saying we never underwrote rent growth, that's what he means is when you look into the engine and transmission of what's under the hood of those projections, those numbers that he's using are what are driving those projections. So let me pitch it back over to you and you can continue on there.
And we underwrote rent growth, but modest, you know, like some operators were saying, you know, when we look at the REITs, you know, when we decide, you know, hey, how do we want to forecast where we're going? You know, we take tons of data and just sort of see what other big players in the space are going to do. And so we look at REIT data, we look at some other companies, et cetera. We do our own modeling, our own analysis of our own portfolio. And we would say, you know, okay, we're going to get maybe 7% rent growth over a 5-year hold, meaning that we think the market is at $10 and it's going to go up 7% from there, up 70 cents over a 5-year hold. Hard to predict that, but very conservative assumptions. The rents grew like 20% year over year, you know, during COVID. And it was just, it was nuts, right? And so we were exceeding pro forma. Everything was coming in, you know, better than projected in the underwriting. And then all of a sudden we had peak pricing. We had peak pricing in asset value. We had peak pricing, you know, we had surging self-storage rents. And then we kind of came off into a cooling off period. in 2022, 2023, where interest rates went super high and rents flatlined or declined. And so that was challenging, right? To kind of, we sort of, I feel like we've had like three climates, you know, climates like in the last 18 months where you had, oh, I don't know what's going to happen, to surging back to, you know, sort of this lull. And now we're sort of in this flatlining space. But, you know, asset values have held tremendously well, which I think is a really important attribute of where CRE, you know, commercial real estate is. I mean, it's definitely asset values are down, but there's still some really great opportunities to buy and build in this market.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that I was just at a conference a month or two ago, and, you know, the story on stage there was, number one, you know, if there was some very challenging projects that got bought in 2021, 2022. And the story on those is survive till 25, you know, until this round of rate hiking. It sounds like the Fed is finished hiking rates, but, you know, there are some projects that are in very challenging situations with short-term bridge debt that's about to expire. They're going to have to refinance or sell into a much higher interest rate environment than what they had projected, but that's going to be buying opportunities for everyone else. So, you know, on the other side, as a buyer, we were talking about how when we look back in 2030, we're going to say 2023, 2024 were the years to buy. And it's going to be like, you know, you made money. Yeah. Well, of course you made money. You bought in 2024. So we just think that this is going to be the most exciting buy opportunities over the next 12, 18, maybe even 24 months that we've seen in a decade. But that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, totally. And it's a lot of it has to do with market inefficiency. And remember, a lot of the values right now are absent of a lot of the publicly traded REITs participating in some of these purchases. You know, so a huge source of capital is not buying right now, but yet prices are still pretty high. You know, when you think about how many, you know, yeah, you hear the doom and gloom of, when you hear commercial real estate, you think office.
Right.
You know, so when you hear the news and you hear about how bad CRE is doing, it's office. And office will impact other asset classes and other investments. Don't get me wrong. Everything's connected. But when you think about how much fixed rate debt is actually out there, you know, especially like home mortgages, you know, I think 95% of Americans are on a fixed rate mortgage that's 30 years long.
Right.
You know, the reality is they're not under the gun to sell. They don't have to get rid of their houses if they don't need to, right? And so when you think about commercial real estate, I think there are going to be some buying opportunities because there's going to be some commercial real estate and some more bank collapses that create inventory that we otherwise didn't have at a time when a lot of the bigger shops aren't buying. So we're experiencing that tailwind now, and you know, there's going to be more and more opportunities to buy. But it also has been pretty darn competitive, you know, considering, you know, the lack of the larger shops buying. So interesting times.
Which is why it's better to build than to buy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean,
it's a great time.
Interesting times. Yeah. Inefficient capital, you know, great time to just be in the game. And, you know, I think we talked about this on a previous podcast where, you know, everybody's like, well, I think I'm just going to wait. You know, until the market goes down, and I'm going to wait for the right time. And, you know, it's all just speculation. When you do that, you know, you want to be investing in a cycle where you know where to sort of like how to ladder your investments in a time and find those niches within each market and always be placing capital and investing. I think it's a, you know, it's a great time for that right now. And I think ground up development could be the answer in this time where it's tight to buy something that exists, but you can build cheaper than what you can buy, and there'll be a demand for the product at the end of the construction. So,
absolutely. I want to speak to your point there about speculation and I might wait. You know, an investor that sits on the sideline for an additional 18 to 24 months, they have to make so much higher of an average annualized return in order to make up for that lost opportunity cost. And the other thing is just a mindset shift of instead of I'm going to wait until like the right moment and then get in. You know, I've completely shifted my attitude from a decade ago where I felt like that because I was a newer investor to just buy, just continually buy. And I made mistakes in selling assets early on in my investing career, which I wish I hadn't. It's like buy and hold, just own the block. So yeah, if I could go back in time, I would never have sold anything that I had bought real estate wise, and I would just re-leverage, just take out additional debt on it because rents climb, it can cover the additional mortgage payment, and then take that because that's tax-free and pour it into more. And I would be a good chunk wealthier today if I'd followed that advice 10 years ago.
Yeah, we even experienced it a little bit during COVID. I mean, Tate, you and I bought property right when the pandemic settled in and nobody was buying and everybody was pencils down and no one knew what was going on. And that turned out to be one of the best buying opportunities of recent time well. And not to say that it's going to go like that again, but because we also had a bunch of influences like $3 trillion being dumped on the economy and,
right.
Tons of government intervention that pushed that up. But, I think the fundamentals are still there and, there's going to be, a great opportunity to be an investor in this market. So I'm excited about what we're doing. We're building three projects in the growth fund right now. We've got,
let's talk
one
about
in
it.
Just, yeah, yeah.
Because so the growth fund is going to have total of, you were saying what, four? We were talking about this the other day.
Probably four, most likely five investments total.
Three that have been identified. And purchased.
Three have been purchased. Yeah. Three have been fully we have all. So when you think about ground up development, I want to just back up a little bit. Riskiest thing you can do in investing is ground up development. Period. Dot. Doesn't matter how good you are, bad you are, what market you're in, it's the riskiest thing you can do. And here's the layers of risk. So number one, getting entitlements, right? That's like getting permission to do it, to build something. If your land is not entitled or doesn't have a site plan, approved, you are doing the most riskiest thing in construction because the city, you could buy a bunch of land and the city says, sorry, you can't do what you want to do there. So now your land is, you got to figure out something else to do with it, right? Or it's worthless. The second step in that is building permits. Building permits are less risky to get because usually if you've got a approved site plan or entitled project, building permits are just code compliance. Right. And usually in your site plan approval, you've gone through that. Right. And then the next risk is construction. So that's like dialing in your contractor and coming out of the ground and building your project. Once you get that project built, your next level risk is leasing the property and filling it up. Right. Because that's when you've expended all the cash and now you're leasing up the property. And then once it's stabilized, that's when the risk really starts to melt off the project because it's entitled, it's built, it's approved, and it's leased, right? All of the projects in the growth fund are fully entitled, they're fully permitted, and all of them that have a construction component have already started construction and there's a contractor identified. Now, luckily, if you're listening to this and you haven't invested, if you invested 7 months ago or 6 months ago in it, you were kind of we didn't buy any properties until they are entitled or permitted, but you were sort of in this like riskier stage. Now the risk has kind of come off of the investments. There's still risk. And don't get me wrong, we still have to lease these things up. And there's always going to be risk in any investment you do. And there's never a guarantee. Yep. But the risk has sort of come off the entitlement and permitting side, making it an excellent time to invest in the fund just before the fund closes, which we expect it to close in December. So, I think that's really good. And the other thing is like the team has been working on these projects for over a year, entitling them, getting them zoned correctly, getting them annexed into the city, going for building permits, et cetera. And now like, it's cool. You open up the picture book and we've got contractors on the site plowing dirt and pouring foundations and coming out of the ground. So it's just making it even more efficient with the funds that are getting funded today. So.
Yeah. Well, super excited about it. This was, you had three opportunities this year. It was the debt, the income, and the growth. And the growth was the one that we really got fired up about. We greenlit this project all the way back in May after doing extensive due diligence on our side. And we were really excited about it. So finally releasing that to investors as of yesterday, as you're listening to this. And yeah, excited to push that out to our investor group.
And you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, with that, any closing thoughts on self-storage before the end of the year? It is the last year for 80% bonus depreciation. So we are expecting a little bit of a tax write-off on this one.
Yeah, and there will be bonus depreciation in the growth fund this year. It won't be a lot. It'll probably be 20%, maybe 10, 20% of your investment. It's not going to be this massive depreciation, mostly because we are buying properties that exist, but most of the properties are ground up development. So that means that there are going to be properties that aren't entered into service yet. And if you don't know what I mean, once we start renting the property, then we can depreciate. So a lot of these properties are going to enter service in 2024. So you get bonus depreciation in 2023, you'll also get it in 2024. And probably in totality, by the end of the investment, about 30% of what you invest will be depreciated. So not bad, but kind of a rolling depreciation opportunity. So
good to know.
The last thing I wanted to talk about too is just the markets. You know, we're north of Jacksonville, Florida, where there's just tremendous growth. Bentonville, Arkansas, you know, for those pilots that go into XNA, it's Northwest Arkansas, which has been 10 times the national population growth, which is incredible. And then the other properties just outside of about an hour and 15 minutes northwest of Orlando in a market called Bellevue, which is right by the Villages. And there's just tons of houses going in, huge community. And Public Storage just bought a 30 property portfolio just about 30 minutes north of that property. So we're really excited about the REIT's interest in potentially buying this property. So
that's great.
A lot of good exit strategies. Yeah.
Well, a lot more information coming on the webinar that we'll be putting on next week. Stay tuned for details on that. And if you haven't heard me say this already, let me just demystify this. We at Turbine Capital have done nearly a half dozen deals with the Spartan team. Couldn't say enough good things about you. I was laughing with you, Ryan, about 6 months ago when we were talking about running this fund, that now that we host a podcast together, it's a little more incestuous than it used to be. Because of course you can invest directly with Spartan or you can come through Turbine. I got the green light from Ryan to disclose to you that on this particular deal, you're going to get a better return by coming through us because we're buying the $3 million share class, the $3 million minimum share class from Spartan, passing on some of those economics to our investors. So unless you have $1 million check that you want to write to Ryan directly, you're going to get a better deal by coming through Turbine on this one. Figured I would demystify that for the group, but always encourage pilots to sign up on both of our lists. Spartan-Investors, I suppose I should let you pitch your own company. You want to go for it?
Yeah, no, Spartan-Investors.com. And I just wanted to address that too. Like, we want to partner with people like Tate. You know, we want people to come in, do their DD on us, invest in our projects. And so anybody who writes a bigger check is going to get a better deal. Yeah, so Tate, you're raising a big check for us. And, you know, we really appreciate that. All the due diligence and the work that you've done. To get this in front of your investors, I think is incredible. So we're happy to be supportive of that.
Thanks, Ryan. Well, we figure, hey, if we can create economies of scale and be sort of a win-win-win between our investor group, ourselves, and Spartan to bring our investors to great projects, it creates a wonderful ecosystem for everyone. So with that, you can find us at turbinecap.com. We'd love to have you on our investor list as well. We obviously participate in storage and a bunch of other stuff in commercial real estate. So with that, Ryan, you want to take us out and look forward to seeing everybody very soon for the webinar on this deal.
Thanks, Tate. And we'll catch you on the next episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And by the way, I'm going to throw in a educational webinar, a link on how to go through an underwriting file in the show notes. So
that'd be excellent.
With that,
thanks, everyone.
See you on the next one.